We'd like to welcome you to the meeting today. We're waiting for Ivan to get here. He's here. We can get started, right?
There you go.
Good. Excited for you to be here. Dave Yor just made a suggestion to him. He says maybe we should open this meeting with a word of prayer like in church basketball, and then we knock him out slugging. Let's see how we best work this out. I appreciate that suggestion. We'll probably forego that, but we can come out slugging him if we need to do that. We're glad that you're here. We've struggled with what to do with all of the excess waters on the Weaver and the Provo systems, and trying to move things just to get it out of our way, right? Especially these last couple of years. We had a real fun year last year trying to get water where it needed to be and put some where it might not have needed to be, and had some questions raised, and we got thinking, you know, we're not going to go through another year like this. We need to get back to operate this system where everybody is comfortable as much as possible. And I often take pride in making decisions in this position I'm in that I don't make anybody comfortable. And if I can make both sides angry, we might be exactly where we need to be. But we're gonna really try to work together here to make this system work. There's a lot of historical data that's available on the Weber and the Provo systems to kind of show how things have worked historically to be able to get us through dry years. And we've had worse years than we've had these last two. And Jared Manning has put together some information that he's going to be talking about today to kind of help walk us through some of the things that we've been considering. I am really committed to replicate what we've historically done, to recognize existing water rights and priorities of water rights, and to recognize agreements and contracts that have been made on the system to help make the system work and to help get water to people and to get water put to beneficial use. So that's part of my responsibility, to be able to work with the distribution, an allocation of water, to distribute that water according to how it's been appropriated and allocated to be able to be used beneficially in the state. But we have some interesting things to be able to work out. We've got a complex system here. We've got a federal project on both river systems and some intertie between those systems to see how they're going to work, and we're going to have to figure out how to best make that work. We've had the luxury of having some great river commissioners on these systems who over the years have done a great job in trying to keep things in balance and keep people somewhat satisfied and working the very best they can do that. Appreciate Stan Roberts and the great work that he's done. And in the past, Wayne Johnson and those two working together. We were talking yesterday, you know, we said that I made a comment about they were able to come to an agreement on how the rivers need to be distributed. Somebody brought up to me they didn't always agree on how that had to be. I don't know, Stan, if that's right. But they didn't always agree, but they always talked through things, and they were able to work it out to the benefit of both sides of the rivers. So what we're trying to do is to come up with a system now to recognize historical operation. I think you've been given a document. Jared, does everybody have one of these? Did anybody not get one? Looks like we're okay. But it's a representation of what we're thinking is the historical operation. We did have an opportunity to meet with a few of you prior to this meeting to kind of let you know what we were thinking and what we'd like to talk about at this meeting. But this meeting is going to be a discussion on what we think we need to do to look at particularly the power water agreement that was 1938 when that agreement was made and when operation of the river system started to take place, and there were some decisions by the state engineers back at that time. I've looked at some of the old documents. I've seen some certificates that reference the certificated rights that seem to refer to other water rights not in the particular certificate, which is a little unusual for the state engineers to do, to address other water rights or other contracts in a certificate. But I think the indication was there that there was an intent on how this thing needed to be operated. And then for about 75 years, we kind of look at this history of how it's gone, and efforts were made to honor those agreements, the water rights, to make sure that the water was distributed properly. And so we want to try to replicate that. We want to try to develop a system that's very transparent. So if anybody has questions, they can go to a website, they can look at numbers, they can see how decisions are being made, they can see where flows are being directed, and you can just see why things are being done the way they're being done. And that's going to be our efforts today. I'm going to have Jared Manning come up and just talk to you about some things that he's put together. Jared is our assistant state engineer for field services. He's responsible for the distribution activities around the state and gives direction to our river commissioners. And so I'd like to turn the time over to him. I'd also like to recognize Reed Cousins. I saw him come in back here too, who was our new commissioner on the Weaver River system. And he's a good man, and I appreciate him being here. And we got a lot of things to talk about and work through with him and give him a lot better direction than we gave him last year. So we're going to work through that, and this is part of this whole process. Is this the only thing we have to do on the Weaver and the Provo River to make everything work? And the answer to that is definitely not. There are other things that we need to do, and there are roles that each of us are going to have to play in this. And we're going to, this is where we're starting. We're going to be working through this. My goal and objective is to, by our distribution meetings this year, have a plan in place of how some of these things are going to operate, so before we begin irrigation season, we have direction to the commissioners on how decisions are going to be made. And then we're going to be working on tools just as much as we can to get those things put together. So I don't know if you have any questions of me before I turn the time over to Jared, but I'll just do that now. Jared, let's go to you, and we'll talk to you. Oh, we are recording the proceedings today. Sorry, I've had Jared's done partly up three times now. We are going to record the proceedings today. I'm guessing they're going now. Okay, so as you start yelling at us, you may want to state your name for the record, so we know who to identify as we listen to it later. But we will have a record of this proceedings if everybody is interested later, and we will have that online, I think, and available. So, Jared, turn the time over to you.
Okay, it looks like everyone got this document as you came in, and that's good. That's what we're going to be going over today. And a lot of you have seen this already, I think. I have added a page at the end that's got some data and information that I want to talk about as well. But what this document outlines is, as Kent mentioned, the historical operation of the Weaver River system in relation to the power contract of 1938. And as we developed this, we met with all the contractual entities. That was the power company, the United States, represented by the Bureau of Reclamation, and the two associations, the Weaver and Provo River Water Users Associations. And so we, you know, took the position, hey, it's their contract. They really need to help us understand what it really means. And so we've been meeting with them and doing research and of the record and trying to understand how historically this is operated. And so that's what we're gonna go over here. The first two sections here, one 2.0 and 2.01. I'm not gonna read through here. I'm just gonna give my summary. And please, as you have questions, let me know, and we'll try and talk through those. But the way this came about was that historically, prior to 1938, power company they produced power, hydroelectric power. The water went into their plant, and then it went back into the river. And during the irrigation season, that was great. The irrigators would use that water after it came back into the river. But during the winter, that water went back into the river, and then it went out to the Great Salt Lake. And I think some very forward-looking people looked at that operation and said, you know what? I think there's a chance for us to develop that winter water that's just going out to the Great Salt Lake. And they said, you know, we could store that water, but in order to do that, of course, we need to compensate the power company because they're going to lose power revenues. But they found a way to make it work where they said, hey, we can compensate the power company and develop this water, and it'll just be a real benefit. So that's the whole theory and idea behind the power contract. As we go into Section 3.0 and 3.0 everything in this document, this is the real nuts and bolts of how it's operated. And so I'll spend a little time walking through this. The first sentence, I think, in 3.0 is really key here. It says the power water agreement was allowed to operate because it did not harm third-party water rights. As we see it, it operated in a manner that didn't harm other water rights. And I think we'd have a completely different discussion today if we were looking at the historical operation and we said, there someone was being impacted or harmed. I think that's a completely different set of circumstances. But the way we understand it, there wasn't harm to other water right holders. And part of the objective of this meeting is to help third-party water right holders understand how it operated, because we want you to be able to evaluate how it's worked and then look at your water rights and go through the same process of analysis that we did, an evaluation, and say, have my water rights been impacted by this contract? And so, as I talked about, we've met with the contractual entities, but a large reason for having this public meeting is for those other entities who are not part of the contract. We think that you need to be protected as well, and a contract just can't operate out there to your harm. So let's go through some of these nuts and bolts here. Section 3, I've actually got divided into three periods. There's a storage period, and that happens during the winter. There's a trade period where the power water is traded across the canal, and in some wet years, there's a spill period, and I'll talk about those. But first, I'm going to talk about the storage period. That happens from about October 15th to April 15th, where essentially we store as much water as we can in Echo Reservoir in order to build that storage up. If it's a real wet year and it looks like, you know, the reservoirs are going to be full, sometimes the entities will not operate the power contract, and instead of storing it, the water will just go out and produce power and go out to the Great Salt Lake. But that's those are the easy years to operate it under, because there's plenty of water. But what's real critical is when we actually do operate it. So let's turn the page here, 3.1.1, and every subsection under 3.1 will refer to the storage period. So 3.1.1, this is the power company entitlement. This is referring to the storage period, and what power company entitlement is in relation to this document is what could the power company have used to divert power? And that's the starting place that you need to know. What water was available to them to produce power? if this contract didn't exist. And they've got a 1903 priority water right to divert 365 second feet. But that doesn't mean there's always 365 second feet there. So in some years, during times of the year, there may only be 300 or less second feet. But they're entitled to whatever is available at the power plant in priority up to 365 second feet. And I should point out, there is a prior right on the system. That's Davidson Weber County's Canal Company for East Canyon. They've got an 1896 water right to store 13,000 acre feet. So water on East Canyon, the first 13,000 acre feet goes to fill up East Canyon, but anything that's left is the power company's entitlement up to 365 second feet. Okay, as we come down to the next section here, you'll see by the numbering system that this is a subset of the power company entitlement. This subsection is referring to power water originating above Echo Dam, and that phrase is taken directly out of the power contract. What this refers to is this is the part of the power company's water that originates above the dam. So some of the water is make below Echo Dam and other tributaries, and when that amount of water is 365 second feet or more, then there is no power water originating above Echo Dam. But when the make below Echo Dam is insufficient to provide 365 second feet, then you have to call water from above Echo Dam in order to satisfy that power right. And so that's an important amount, because that's the amount that can be stored under the contract. So for instance, if it was wet and there was 365 second feet of make below the dam, there wouldn't be any power water to be stored because all the power water is making it to the plant. Okay, so that's an important concept to understand. Again, the amount that the power water originating above the dam is what is contractually able to. There's three things that can happen to that water. It can be stored in Echo, it can be diverted directly across the Weber-Provo Canal, or if the power company, if the power contract is not operating, it can just flow down and create power as it historically did. And so these next three sections talk about each of those three cases. So you got power water diverted through the Weber-Provo Canal. Again, that can only happen if there is power water above Echo Dam. Then you can also store power water in the reservoir, or you can not store it. And that's what those next three sections, as I talked about, discuss. So that brings us, let's turn the page to page 3. Now we're talking about 3.1.2. Again, we're talking about the storage period. We're still in section 3.1 here. And the title of this subsection is Withheld Weber River Waters. This is another phrase from the contract. What withheld Weber River waters refers to is the sum of the water both diverted directly through the canal and stored. So this is the contract water, the sum of what was diverted and what was stored. And by the way, that withheld Weber River water gets divided 50-50 between the two associations, between Weber River water users and Provo River water users. Let's go to 3.1.3. We talk about the accounting of power water. There's been some question in our discussions about how do you account for power water in relation to the other water rights in Echo Reservoir. Echo's got a 74,000 acre foot water right, and so if you've got power water right, power water as well, is it 74,000 plus that? How much can you really store? And I think what this section is pointing out is that There's 74,000 acre feet of water that can be stored in ECHO under all water rights and contracts. And so the contract isn't adding extra water that can be stored. It just helps get to that 74,000 acre feet faster. And that's the real benefit of this contract to Weber River water users, is they can get to that 74,000 acre feet a lot faster by storing that winter water. In dry years, if they didn't store that winter water, they might still fill if it was a wet year, but if it's a dry year, they wouldn't fill without that. Okay, so that's the storage period, and again, I was talking about October 15th to April 15th. After that time, the storage period ends. We've done the accounting. We know how much power water there was accounted for during that time. It's split 50-50. Half of it goes to Weber River water users. Half of it goes to Provo River water users. Of course, they've already probably diverted some of that half through the canal directly, but the remaining amount is sitting in ECHO, and now they've got to get it out of ECHO. And this is a key thing to understand. ECHO, of course, is downstream from the Weber-Provo Canal, and so you can't divert it directly out. You'd have to have a big pump that pumped it up to the diversion or something, but rather than do that, they trade it out for excess flows in the river. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what do excess flows mean, and how can you make this trade operate without harming anybody else? Because again, it's a tricky thing to exchange water and take it above the reservoir. I think it's quite clear if you're going to take water below a reservoir, you just release it and it comes to your canal and you take it. But in order to take water above the reservoir, there's got to be extra water up there. And by extra or by excess, it's excess flows from the perspective of the upper users. They're not excess flows for the system as a whole. They're flows that would have, without the power contract existing, they would have flowed down past the reservoirs and satisfied rights below ECHO Reservoir. And so they weren't in the river to satisfy the rights up at Oakley, for instance. They're in the river to satisfy the rights lower down on the system. And the way this exchange works is that you can take those excess flows up in Oakley and then release an equivalent amount from ECHO Reservoir to those lower users. And so they end up getting the water that they would have gotten anyways. And that's how this works. There are really sort of two scenarios on making this trade work. The first one is sort of a normal scenario, which most of us are pretty familiar with, and that is when it's not a really dry year. And historically, we find, I had to go all the way back to 1992 to find a year where we operated it differently than this historical operation. But 3.2.2, I've got two paragraphs in there operating the trade. One of them is the normal scenario, and one of them is the dry scenario. In the normal scenario, what is going to happen is ECHO Reservoir is going to be filling. And so as you exchange that water across the canal, rather than release that water out of the reservoir, you keep it in there and essentially reassign it to Weber River water users. And so the reservoir continues to come up, but you change the name of the water on paper. You had this block that was Provo River water users, but as they take it across, now their block becomes smaller and Weber River water users' block becomes larger. You're just trading that water straight across. And I think most people are comfortable with that. That's how it normally operates. And it's just when you get into this other mode of operation that you see concerns, and that was a concern we saw this year. And that's, well, what happens if it's a fairly dry year and the ECHO water rights aren't even on? The 1924 water rights aren't on. Can you still operate the trade? And you can, but the trick here is, as you take water across the Lieber-Provo Canal, you actually have to release it from ECHO Reservoir downstream to meet the demands below. And so what you see on the system, if you're standing over on the Weber River system, you're going to see water going across the Lieber-Provo Canal, and at the same time, you're going to see the level of the reservoir go down. And I think that's difficult for people to understand. They're saying, well, how can they be taking water across the canal while the reservoir is going down? That doesn't seem right. But the way it operates, you got to remember that there's a block of water in ECHO that belongs to Provo River water users, and so they can take that across and release an equivalent amount back into the system, and that's how the trade operates in a really dry year. And again, we had to go back to 1992 to find a year where that happened. But I've got a graphic at the end that I'll explain some of that a little bit further. Hopefully that'll be clear. And that's a critical point to understand. All right, so let's turn it to page 4 here. We've talked about storing the water during the winter. That was 3.1. We talked about trading the water. That was 3.2. Occasionally, you'll actually spill some of the water out of the reservoirs. And historically, when there was only ECHO reservoir, that water would spill out of ECHO. And the power water spills first. And so if it hasn't been exchanged across, it's lost by the Provo folks. And so they take a chance a little bit. They roll the dice a little bit when they go on the power contract. The risk that they're taking is that their water might spill out of the reservoir before they can take it over. Now that other reservoirs, Rockport particularly, have come online, what happens normally is that ECHO water is not just stored in ECHO, it's also stored in Rockport. And so we don't always get a physical spill of this ECHO water. What you get is a paper spill, where you reach that 74,000 acre feet of storage, and on paper that water starts spilling out. And so as we account for this water, even though there's no physical spill over the spillway, as we reach that level of the water right of ECHO Reservoir, which is 74,000, that excess water spills out. Provo River water users lose it on paper, but it ends up spilling to the next appropriator, which would be Weber Basin water. And so it just remains in Rockport Reservoir and gets renamed Weber Basin water. So that's a paper spill, and it's a good thing to happen. And when we're spilling, usually people are happy and we don't have problems. You go down here to 3.4. There's a July 1 deadline, and the July 1 deadline, I talked about the risk that Provo River water users takes when they store power water. One risk is that it can spill out. The other risk is that they can't get it all moved across by July 1st. And if there's still some power water on July 1st that they weren't able to move over, then it becomes Weber River Water Users Association water. So that's, again, that's the nuts and bolts of how we understand that it is historically operated. And this Section 4.0, future operations, what we're talking about here, and I'm just going to reiterate a little bit of what Kent said, is we intend to operate as we have historically, according to this document. And by the way, this is a draft document. It's not final, and we do want you to look at it and provide feedback, and we'll probably set a comment period. I'm thinking something like 30 days or something like that. Kent mentioned that we want to have something in place by our distribution meetings, which are usually about the third week in January. And so if I do my math, let's see, we're the end of October, that 30 days or so puts us towards the end of November, and then that gives us a month and a half to sort of finalize things. So that's sort of the time period we're looking at. But we want you to have enough time to analyze what we've done, what we presented here, and particularly if you're a third party, you're not part of the contract, we want you to look at it in, from the perspective of, does the operation of this contract affect my water rights negatively? And if they do, that's what we want to hear. I think that's one of the main purposes of this meeting, is to get input from those third-party folks. Reiterate something else Kent talked about. We are developing some tools, some online tools, to help track the accounting of water on the system. I just think it sort of takes that black box away and, you know, move the curtain back and reveal just what's going on. And it'll hopefully be a real-time tool so you can see day-to-day what's going on and what data the commissioner is using to make his decisions. And it'll just be transparent. And I think transparency in distribution has been proving to be a very positive thing. And it's because of the technology that we have now with real-time gauges and telemetry and presenting it online that we can do that. But, I mean, historically, we haven't had that ability. And so it's been done on trust and that sort of thing. So before we go to this last page, which that's the page with the graph, any questions on any of the historical stuff, Dennis?
I have several.
Okay. But if you do it one at a time, I might be able to keep up.
To start with, we have a water right that is non-consumptive.
Okay.
And so my question then, when it enters Echo Reservoir, is it still non-consumptive?
Okay, and that's a great question, and one that I personally puzzled over for a long time. And I think the way you have to look at it is, from the perspective of these early water users, where was that water, where would it have ended up when it created power? It would have ended up in the lake. And so by storing that water, it became extra water to the system. And so there are some different theories about which water right that is stored under. Is it the power water that is stored there? I think the Bureau would say, well, it's not really the power water that's stored there. It's really Bureau rights that are stored there. Bureau rights are consumptive. And I think they would say, all we did is paid the power company not to divert their rights, but to divert ours instead. And so if you look at it from that perspective, that really what you're doing is storing Bureau rights in there, which are consumptive, then I think that question is answered. But I still think it's answered, too, if you say, well, it's really the power company, the power rights, but you're storing water that would have gone out to the lake. So there's no impact, I guess, is the bottom line. As long as there's no impact, then I think it's okay.
Can I continue this?
Yep.
Okay, so it becomes non-consumptive when it hits Echo. So therefore it's non-consumptive, or it becomes consumptive when it hits Oakley. And we're using a Bureau water right to transfer it from the Weaver River to the Provo River?
Well, what I'm saying is, as you store that power right...
I'm having a real tough time wrapping my head around these concepts. saying we originate with a non-consumptive power generating monorite in the mouth of Weber Canyon. We move it to Echo Reservoir, and now it has storage attached to it. Then we move it to Oakley, and now we're moving that water from one drainage basin to another, mm-hmm. all on a contract, all with no change application being filed through the state engineer. The appropriation process has not been completed, and there's no change on this water right. So you... The difficult part for me is starting out with a non-consumptive water right in the mouth of Weber Canyon, moving it to Echo, moving it to Oakley, and then finally moving it to the Provo River. And when it moves to the Provo River, it's 100% consumptive to the Weber River system. And there must be some mind block on my part, because I can't imagine how that could happen.
Okay, now, Dennis, I said only one question at a time, and that was like three, but I'll still give it a shot. Well, maybe it was four.
Well, they're all interconnected.
They are. I think the overarching concept that you got to keep in mind is somebody being impacted? Are there third-party water rights that are being impacted? And so if you've got power water that would have gone out to the lake, but instead you say we're going to store it, okay, that's the first thing you got to say is who's impacted by that?
I can document that this spring.
I'm talking about the winter right here.
Third-party water rights that were impacted this spring, I can document.
Okay, but let's concentrate on one at a time. So October 15th to April 15th, this is water that would have gone out to the lake if it had generated power, okay? Instead of going out to the lake, it was stored. And so you got to say, well, who's impacted by that? Well, no one's impacted by it. That's water that would have ended up in the lake. That's extra developed water that is now in the system. And at that point, it doesn't matter where you do with it, what you do with it or where you take it. From the perspective of third parties, no one was impacted in order to store it. So whether you take it over to the Provo or you use it on the Weber, is no impact. It would have been out. It would have been in the lake. And so that's again, you have to say who is impacted by it. Okay. So the next question or the next point in sort of your general question is, well, what water right exists for it? And that's a tough question to answer. I think there are, as I said, there are several theories on how that happens, but on the Weber River system, as it turns out, the way we've historically operated is there are really a lot of these types of situations where water, for instance, Echo water is stored in Rockport every year. Is there an exchange or a change that allows that? I haven't been able to find one, but we understand that is the most efficient way to operate the system. It benefits everyone to store water as high in the system as possible. And I can go on. There's several of these types of distribution exchanges that are made on paper that don't impact people that we make in order to maximize the use of the water. I think, at least from the storage period, I've answered your questions. Is anyone impacted, and what water rights is it done under? Now you're talking about the trade period. How can it be done without impacting others? And Dennis, I understand you have concerns with how it was operated this year, and I think a lot of us do. I think if we would have given the commissioner more timely information as he asked it from us. We probably would have done things a little bit differently. And he asked us, he said, "Hey, I'm new here. Tell me how to do it." And we said, we looked at it and said, "Oh man, we got to figure this out." Meanwhile, the water runs down the river, and he's got to tell it where to go. And so he did the best job he could this year, and I think he did the best with the information he had. So if you can identify things this year that you think may not have been perfect, okay, I think I can take responsibility for that. But I'm talking about historically how we would have operated it. I think if we would have operated it correctly, then things wouldn't, people wouldn't have been impacted if we did it correctly. So
have you identified what those incorrect things are? Made a list? Says this is what we're going to do to change it?
Well, that's what we're doing here, is we're trying to identify how it should be done so that in future years, next year and the year after, that we get it right. And that's really the purpose of what we mean.
One item of that list that you're correcting.
One item on that list?
Yeah.
Well, I think one item is that you can exchange water across the canal even if you've made cuts to the system. If you've cut down below flood, you can still exchange water across because you're releasing an equivalent amount from the reservoir.
And that's where I have a problem with your analyzation of it, is because in order to make that water available, you have to make cuts so that the water is available at Oakley. And when you make those cuts, there are local water users that provide water to those cuts. And when their canal flow is diminished, that water is returned to the river and the Provo Canal takes it. That's the other part of this whole thing that I can't comprehend.
Okay. And I understand that's hard to comprehend because I struggled with it for a long time myself. But maybe it's a good time to transition into this last page, because the whole point of providing this last page in this graph is to address that very concept, Dennis, that you just brought up. And so I want to talk about this and how that exchange worked historically. And hopefully this will help a little bit. So I mentioned before that you had to go back to 1992 to find a water year that was drier than 2013. And 92 actually was drier than 2013. And I've got some facts here that help you understand it. The nice thing in 1992 was we started the year with more carryover storage. You see there were 62,000 acre feet of carryover versus this year, since we were in the second consecutive dry year, we only had 28,000. But if you look at the maximum storage in those years, in 1992, they got up to 113,000 acre feet. So that they increased their storage by about 51,000 acre feet during the winter. Okay, you look at 2013, we went from 28,000 to 96,000. So we started the year with less water, the irrigation season in 2013, than we did in 92. But the amount of water that we stored during the winter was 58,000 or 68,000 versus 51. So you can see 2013 was a little wetter than 1992. But we started the year with less carryover and therefore had less total storage to play with once we got into the irrigation season. To continue the comparison down there, 1992, ECHO shares were at 60% allocation. This year they're at 75%. And again, the reason in 92 why they were less is because the amount that was stored during the winter was less. There was more total storage, but a lot of that was Rockport storage. So ECHO only had a 60% allocation. As you go to that last bullet point, priority cuts in 1992, they actually cut off 1861 water rights. And I know that doesn't happen very often at all. Maybe there were other years where we cut 1861, but if there were, there were very few. And it was cut for about 3 weeks, 1861. If you look at 2013, I think the deepest cuts we made were 1869. So again, 2000 or 1992 was drier than 2013. And if you come down and look at this chart, you've got two lines on there. The dotted line at the top, that is showing the total storage. And by total storage, I'm talking Echo, Rockport, Smith, and Morehouse. And on the left-hand axis, you see the acre feet of storage. You know, they started about 62. You see they went up to about 113,000, and then they ended the year at about 20,000. The bottom line, that is Weaver Provo Canal diversions. And that started about November 8th. And during the winter, they're not taking very much through because of ice and things. And by the way, the axis is on the right-hand side for the Weaver Provo Canal diversions in second feet. And you see during the spring there, they were 200 to 300 acre feet, or sorry, second feet that were being diverted. What I want to point out on this graph is that storage peaked right about in the middle of April. And you can see that on the graph. It peaked, and then they started diverting through the Weaver Provo Canal. And what happened is, as they diverted through the Weaver Provo Canal, the storage in Echo actually went down. And the reason that happened is because what they were diverting, what Provo River Water Users was diverting across the canal, was water that was stored in Echo. And so for each acre foot they diverted, they had to release it in order to make the system whole. Okay, so it's a trade. You divert an acre foot, you release an acre foot from storage. No one's harmed. If you take one and leave one, it's like when you go geocaching, you know. You go and you find it. There's a geocache right out in front, by the way. If you ever see people digging around in the bushes, I don't know if you've ever done that, but I saw some people digging around the bushes one time, and it's doing over geocaching. They found it. But you take one, and then you put something back of equal value. You don't just take it and leave it empty. And that's the same concept here. You take one, you release from storage to make people whole. And as you look at what happened, we were about 113,000 acre feet peak, and then they diverted through the Weaver Provo Canal late in April, and they diverted 13,600 acre feet. That's the bullet below the graph. 13,000 acre feet of water was exchanged out of Echo Reservoir between April 16th and June 5th. And you can see that total storage number decreases over that time by about 13,000 acre feet. It was a one-for-one trade of that water. Okay, and so I think perhaps what people would have said is, again, how can you be taking water across the Weaver Provo Canal while you've made cuts to the system and the level of the reservoir is going down? And the reason is because that water in storage has Provo River Water Users' name on it. Okay, and they can take it and release it and trade that water. And if you look down to the very last bullet, the distribution, this shows what level of cuts we were on that year. So we were on low water from April 16th to May 9th. Okay, it went up to high May 10th to May 24th, and we were on flood for a week there from May 25th to June 1st. And then cut from flood all the way down to low from June 2nd to June 8th. While we were on that flood from May 25th to June 1st, 1924 water rights were never put on. There was never any Echo water or Deer Creek water available on the system that year at all. But what I'm trying to point out is that even though that was the case, we were still able to exchange, you know, over 13,000 acre feet of water across the canal because it was because of the power contract allowed that one for one trade of water to happen.
Dennis?
Why is water measured at Francis rather than Camas and Oakley through the canal?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Is that something that's going to change in the future?
I'm not sure. I think it's a good question. You look at the contract, and there seem to be some indications of where it should be measured, but I think the position we're taking on contractual interpretation things, if there are disagreements between the parties, that they really need to, it's their contract, and they really need to come together and figure out how to interpret it. Because the state engineer isn't really equipped to interpret contracts.
That's not being the same standard there is not being met with other water users in Oakley. I mean, they divert water from the river and it's measured shortly thereafter. Any transmission or conveyance losses from the measuring device to the place of use is stored by whoever is diverting the water.
I understand.
So why is that concept not carried over to the Weber Provo Canal, and any transmission or conveyance losses the canal incurs should be borne by them?
Well, and I think historically what the theory has been is that they've kept that water and the water level in the Weber Provo Canal artificially high on purpose so that it doesn't act as a drain on the system, and so it actually contributes water in the Oakley area.
But that has a direct effect on your accounting numbers on what gets sent over.
I understand. But
and the transmission and conveyance losses are not accounted for by the Weber Provo Canal, but they are shifted to someone else.
Well, those losses become a gain to the people in Oakley, is what it turns out to be, because it becomes water that can be diverted by others. But historically, where we
actually to deliver water, you need it to stay in the river.
Well,
it's in the river. It's not available for downstream users, and it has an effect on the accounting for the upstream users.
Right, I understand what you're saying, but those losses are staying on the Weber side. I'm just telling you the theory that it's operated under historically.
So can we expand that theory to other water users and say we're going to put their measuring device at the end of the ditch?
Well, and what you have to remember is that this is stored water. This is extra water on the system that's being diverted. It's not direct flow. And so there's a different standard between direct flow and storage sometimes.
But not in measuring.
In this case, there is. But again, that's...
I'm not wrapping my head around that concept. Could you expand on that one?
Well, I will, Dennis. But again, this is an issue that I think is fair to address with the contractual entities who run this, and I think they need to come together and say where's the fair place to measure the water. Okay, from our point of view, we need to make sure that wherever the water is measured, that there is no impact to third party water rights. That's our position on this, and so and we'll continue to look at that. I don't think there's an impact to third party water rights wherever you measure it.
There's a different standard.
Well,
I mean, there would be a big impact to water users in Oakley if their measuring devices have the end of it.
Okay, but again, what we're trying to do here is say, does the operation of the contract impact third-party water rights? And where you measure stored water being diverted across, it doesn't matter where you measure it, if you measure it at the beginning or the end, because it's stored water that's coming across.
Well, these other ditches also have stored water that's delivered through their ditches.
Yeah, I understand.
And so do you measure direct flow at the river, and then if you've got direct storage water, you're going to measure it at the end?
Again, the way this contract operates is it's got to operate not to impact others. And what you're saying is, well, I can see that it doesn't impact others, but I just don't like the way that it operates. And so, again, if there's issues with the way that it operates, then I think that's up to the contractual entities to decide whether they're doing it correctly or not.
But are you telling me these guys that signed that contract are going to tell where to measure water?
Under the contract, that's right.
Is that what you're telling me?
The contractual water is something that they have to tell us how to operate the contract, because it's their contract.
And Dennis, I think what we'll do is, you've got a concern that maybe that ought to be measured someplace differently. We'll note that for the record, and we'll talk about that. You've got a concern there, and we'll talk to the contract holder to see if in fact that is causing detriment to the system. We'll have to make that decision. Jared's telling you he doesn't think it's causing a problem. You've got a concern with it. We'll just make a note of that and see what we can do to address it. So is there something else that you want to talk about, too? I mean, Jared may not give you everything that you want to have today, okay? But we're trying to get concerns out so we know what we need to address.
Well, measuring is a big concern right now.
Okay, and that's noted. Measuring is a big concern. We'll make a note of that, see what we can do to address it. We'll make the decision whether we think that's critical or not. But, so what else have we got?
You said that the water below HECO is the critical for cutting rights, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
That's
accurate.
Start cutting rights, they're cut all the way on the river from everything. But if we start putting water across the canal and we don't have enough water in the river to meet the rights in Oakley, but you're letting enough water out of the reservoir to meet the rights below the reservoir, mm-hmm. is that a problem or am I not seeing things correctly?
Let's say we're cut to 1890, for instance. Okay, what you're going to see up in Oakley is you're going to divert your 1890 water rights, and let's just forget the power contract and reservoirs for that matter. If we're cut to 1890 on the system, you're going to be able to divert 1890 water, but there's going to be a bunch more water in the river, and where's that water going to go to? It's going to go downstream, and it's going to meet those 1890 and earlier water rights downstream. So if you keep that picture in mind, again, there is no reservoir, there is no power contract. You're sitting in Oakley diverting 1890 and then watching the rest of the water flow downstream down to Davison, Weber, Morgan counties. Now, if you overlay a reservoir and a power contract on that, you ought to be in the exact same position that you were without it. And so if we're at an 1890 priority cut, you're going to be able to divert your 1890 water rights, and that water, rather than flowing downstream to meet the downstream water rights, it's going to go across the canal. But for every acre foot that's diverted across that canal, there's going to be an acre foot that's let out of the reservoir, and it's going to go downstream to meet the water rights below ECHO. So everyone ends up in the exact same position that they would have been had the reservoir and the power contract not been there. And that's how it operates.
Jared, is there ever going to be a time when the rights are cut to 1890 and those intervening users between the Provo Weber Canal and ECHO can't divert their 1890 rights? If they've got an 1890 right, is there going to be not enough water in the river to divert those?
I think there could be, theoretically. You could get to a point where there isn't excess water up in the upper part of the river to send, in which case you can only divert across what is excess. But I think because of the way the river is set up, most of the larger water rights are down on the system, are down lower on the system. In most, if not all years, what you see is you see that excess water up there.
But in the situation he's talking about, if that ever happened and the intervening users couldn't get their water, then water could not be taken across the Weber-Provo Canal in excess of water that would be needed to satisfy those intervening users. I mean, that water would have to be released down to satisfy them.
Yep.
But anything in addition to that then could go across the canal.
And there are exactly a lot of years when the canal is cut off and no water is allowed to go across. And that's at the direction of the Weber Commissioner. And so if the rights downstream that are, have a priority over the rights that are the storage and power contract rights need to be satisfied, then we allow that water to go down to satisfy those rights at the Commissioner's request.
Yeah, so if again, we were at 1890, the Commissioner's going to look at all the water rights from Echo on up and say, do I have enough water to satisfy all the 1890 water rights there? And he's going to make sure that happens first. And anything extra is what can be taken over. If there's not enough to satisfy the 1890 water rights, then there's got to be an additional cut that's made on the system. So it would be a cut
on what can go across the Weber-Provo Canal. You'd have to send water down to satisfy it. Water has to bypass the canal to come down to satisfy those rights.
So the answer to his question is no. That's not going to happen. The intervening users are not get theirs with it going across. They'll be satisfied.
They'll be satisfied, but the real tricky thing is what is satisfied mean? If the cut has been to 1890, then yeah, all the 1890s will be satisfied. But if by satisfied you mean their flood rights, then that's not necessarily the case, because the river is going to have a certain cut that we're going to operate under. So that's the level of water that has to be met. Ivan?
My name's Ivan Ray. I represent Weber River Water Users Association and Davis and Weber Canal, I guess, for the recording. We sent some comments down some time ago, I remember, on the Weber-Provo Canal diversions. And also, we logged some comments last week I gave to you on some of our perspective on the operation of the power contract. Will there be an opportunity to maybe meet with the state again? I'm not saying we're exclusive by any means from individual operators or users, but it is a big water right that will affect a lot of reservoirs and distribution on our system. I've researched our board minutes and also stockholder minutes that revert back to the power contract. And in those minutes, all the parties that voted on this on the Weber side wanted to make sure that the impacts would not affect the distribution of water that they were used to. And hence, like page 25 and 26 in the contract, especially page 26, the end of the paragraph under number 22, where it says, it is further understood and agreed that the Weber River power water accruing to the Weber River Association under the provisions of this contract shall be used only to augment the storage supply of the Echo Reservoir to the extent of filling said reservoir once each year to its capacity of 74,000 acre feet and not otherwise. And so we will make more comments, but we would like the opportunity to have an audience again with the state maybe in this disposition, because this meeting is such that we don't have time to go over every little detail. Our thing is, when we talk about excess water or natural flow or direct flow, how the water rights will fit in. Echo Yellow last year ended up with about 63,000 acre feet, and it was confusing. I know it was going back and forth. Some of it may have been power water, some of it may have been excess flow past us past. We don't want to go there, but we are concerned because I think we're going to be in multiple drought years, and I think Provo would be concerned as well because we're the two entities affected. And so we need to be able to work together and gear up and plan. And accounting through the River Commissioners is important. Both sides, Stan Roberts, Reed Cousins, and those communications. And I won't say any more. Thanks.
Yeah, and I think there will be a chance to both provide written comments and to meet as well. Again, we are seeking your input. And so if you've got input to provide, then please provide it. Any other questions or concerns about anything that we've talked about?
Does the construction on Echo, does it affect water rights downstream?
The construction on Echo, that might be something that Ivan could. It shouldn't, but she's asking about the construction on Echo, and whether that affects water rights downstream.
You know, we were fortunately, it was a drought year last year for the embankment portion. It's complete now. And once that was completed and signed off as completed, we were on what's called first fill. But unfortunately, there wasn't enough runoff, so we're still under first fill. By March 31st of 2014, the spillway part of the project should be complete. Once that happens, we would like to jump on board and do first fill, because we obviously have to do that according to the requirements of the Bureau of Reclamation a first time, just to test everything, I guess you might say. So our goal is to go ahead and do that. We drew down as low as 7,300 acre feet this year. In 2012, it went as low as 4,300 acre feet. Part of it was to assist in the construction for an upstream embankment portion they had to put in place there. And the other part was the drought year. So in answer to the question, really the construction this year shouldn't affect the reservoir, because by March 31st we got some big holes. And the only reason we store Echo water, I've never heard of it being stored in Smith & Morehouse, any of Echo, unless I haven't had any records toward that, and I've talked to Reed Cousins about that. But we will store the water as high as we can just to complete this project, but it'll be credited to Weaver River and Echo, and that'll be drawn down from Rockport as a storage facility. And so there's two big holes there. They're pretty significant. And so I personally, the way things are going, this month hasn't been much better. I don't think we're going to change the patterns much to what it's been the last, at least 2012, and so 2013 will be low. So we may not be able to do first fill this year either. But irregardless, the contractor is supposed to be complete so that after March 31st, if there was sufficient water in the river, we could fill Echo to capacity, and then we'd draw it down according to demand. Does that answer? Sorry, I'm going to get carried away.
That was good information. Any other questions or concerns? Boyd?
Just for clarification, so you're taking written comments. Are we going to publish those comments and answers? Those comments or questions?
Yeah, I think that's what we've done with past public meetings is we've taken, we'll have the recording of the meeting out there on our page. We'll have the graphs that we have presented, comments that are submitted, and then typically we'll provide a response to those comments, and then eventually a final document. Sometimes these things are iterative, and you know, there are other public meetings that are involved. I'm not thinking that we're going to be in an iterative process on this. We'll make that determination when we see, you know, all the comments and concerns. But our hope is to have, as we mentioned earlier, a final document by the distribution meetings next year.
So should we see much of a change to what's been going on?
The question was, should we see much change to what's going on? And the answer is that the intent is to not change anything that has historically happened under the 75 years of the power contract. Where the change might be is in what the water supply is. And there may, you know, if Ivan's right, and we're in our third year of drought, we're going to be in a place we've never been before. But I think the guidelines that we've developed here are sufficient to allow us to operate under those conditions.
So, Jared, briefly, we can log in our comments, and if so need be, can we request time to meet maybe with the state again to go over some things, or is that okay? And personally, I think it'd be, maybe be good that Provo be brought in at a point and have a combined meeting. I think it'd be good. I really respect these two gentlemen.
Well, we've accomplished one thing.
That's on the record, too. That's great. That's great. Anything else? Jared, do we want to set a date to get those comments
in? Yeah, that's a good point. Does 30 days seem adequate? I suppose maybe we can go as much as 45 days. I don't, with the time limits we're going to have as far as the third week in January, if we go past, say, 45 days, which puts us into, what, the second week of December, that compresses our time to respond and finalize things. But is there any objection to, like, say, a 30-day comment period? Let's see, what's the... Thanksgiving is what, on the 28th this year?
29th would be the day after Thanksgiving. It might be good to at least push it a week after that.
35 or 36 and a half.
To go to this, like, December 6th would be Friday of the following week.
December 6th for comments, I think. So that's
we could move it to Saturday the 7th and have that be the day of infamy, right?
Well, and I guess the other thing, I mean, it doesn't really matter if it comes in on Saturday or Sunday.
I think the 6th probably would be good, though, on the Friday. Just get it in to a Friday. But.
We'd appreciate it, because as you well know, we are in the process of doing a Weaver River Management Plan. Jay Henry's been doing a yeoman job, and he's had different entities reviewing some of the information in the documents, so it'll give him a little time to kind of finish some of that up, because I think that'll be kind of a Bible, if you will, as far as Weaver River to operate.
And I know he's waiting on us to finalize some of that stuff, so... That's just an example of the, I don't know if I should say the private sector operating faster than the public sector. There's a reason, I think, why sometimes it takes a while, because we want input.
Is that solid? Public, as soon as they come in by the internet?
Yeah.
Or
I think so. We'll scan them in, you know, probably the same day and put them on the internet.
Because that'll be as much an educational experience as anything else, you know, to learn where everyone else is coming from and know what their desires are. And maybe, you know, there'll be some problems on the Weaver-Davis issues that the Provo side will learn why we're coming from that direction. And so I think that's as important as anything you can do, is to make them public as soon as you get them, and then watch and see what your responses are to that particular problem. To teach us all why you're coming from the direction you're coming.
Jared, is there a reason why you have to release it, January 1st, I guess?
We want to be ready to talk at our annual distribution meetings.
Okay.
So that we can give instructions to the commissioners there and talk to the committees about where we're going.
Right. That's in January.
That's in January. Okay. And usually about the second or third week, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm optimistic that we'll be there. I suppose if we go down this path and there are just issues that we haven't considered, and, you know, I suppose that could be pushed now, you know, pushed back a little bit. But I don't think that we'll be there.
Jared, where do you want the comments sent? You want them to come to you?
Actually, that would be good. Just send them directly to, you know, attention Jared Manning. You could do it Kent Jones, but I think it'll get to me faster if my name's on there, and then we can get it on the website faster rather than going through Kent.
So that would be something written that you're going to send in. Send it to attention to Jared Manning. And our address is what?
Here.
I don't know where I live.
What is it? It's 1594. Yeah, it's on our.
It should be on the letter that you received. Yeah.
1594 West North Temple, Salt Lake City. I'm trying to think of what the P.O. box number is.
Well,
that's
is it yours?
Jared Manning at Utah.gov.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. You could send it directly by email.
Yeah.
Jared Manning at Utah.gov.
And then you'll distribute it how you need it.
Did you establish the website and the address you want to send to?
And our website, if you haven't been there, is waterrights.utah.gov. And by the way, we usually have a PowerPoint. I decided to just go just old school today. No electronic, well, except for recording, paper all the way. And so usually we'll put that up there. But if you go to waterrights.utah.gov, that's got our address, but our address is 1594 West North Temple, P.O. Box 146300, Salt Lake City, and it's 84114. And if you need that afterwards, I'll be happy to give you a card or something, but I think you should be able to find it on the website.
Worked out good, Jared. We've got a lot of old schoolers here, so fit right.
That's what I was thinking.
On our website, we will have posted a bullet point dealing with this issue, so you can go right to that. Should be able to click onto it, and that'll take you into the information. So there'll be a flag on the website. So, you know, sometimes you can get through several pages and kind of get lost trying to find things. We'll try to have that on the front page, the announcement, so that you can find it and get the information. If you have troubles, give us a call, but it should be right there and available.
Any other questions or concerns? Did you want to?
And I just wanted to say this is a thing that we've been struggling with a lot about how best to do this. My opinion is if we get back to historical operations, it's going to work very well. Are we going to have disagreements still? Yeah, we will. We're going to have things worked out, but we're going to have some tools to make those decisions. And I see a critical role here, too, in a Weaver River and a Provo River project with the Bureau of Reclamation's involvement and issues there to kind of help provide us with some tools and information that we can see and be able to use and to be able to help make some decisions on how these projects are supposed to be operated, you know, under some of the base rights. And so we're looking for help from them. We're looking for help from all of you to help this work together. We don't want to leave our commissioners hanging out and having things thrown at them, trying to make decisions the best they can. Historically, they've done a great job satisfying both sides. And did we get everything that we want to get? Most years we don't. Some years we got way too much. But most years, I think decisions have to be made how to best split those and meet the best we can everybody's needs. So we're looking for everybody's input. We need to collectively do this. We can fight about it. We can go to court. And I've done that. And that's not the funnest thing. And the best way to resolve problems, because you can't get answers that you still don't understand what you need to do. So it's better for us to work together and come to an agreement. That's really what we're trying to facilitate here. So please participate with us. Let us know of your concerns. Help us address what we need to have addressed here. And then we're going to make it work. I think we can do it. We've got a bunch of good people on both sides who are very interested in getting water where it needs to be. And that's what my job is to do that, to satisfy the water users as best we can and get the waters of the state put to their most beneficial use. That's what we're trying to do here. So thank you so much for being here. We'll appreciate your comments and input. And we're happy to meet with you. We're happy to talk through this. We're going to try to push to meet our deadline. So thank you. Thank you very much. Anything else here? We thank you for being here. Yeah.